Happy New Year, everybody. And depending on your perspective, 23 is finally here, or maybe you can't believe that 2023 is already here. Sometimes, depending on the situation and the day, I can feel it from both perspectives. I'm Nick Deolius, your host. This is the Far Middle Podcast, and we are starting the new year with episode 85. By the way, this episode's marking the third calendar year that the Far Middle has been making connections for all of you constant listeners, which means it's a great time to thank you for your attention and your interest. Certainly appreciate it. Now, our dedication for 85 is going to go to a truly iconic team, and that's a label in terms of being an iconic team that applies across all of professional sports when it comes to this particular dedication. The team is the 1985 Chicago Bears in the National Football League, and the 85 Bears, they earned the status of iconic for three crucial reasons. First, they were extremely entertaining to watch when playing on the field. It was basically must-see TV back in the day. And second, the data and the accomplishments of that team that year were spectacular. Super Bowl champions, of course, a damn near perfect season, blemished only by one loss, and a season on defense that was truly for the ages when you looked at the statistics. If you remember, a ways back, we dedicated episode 46 to Buddy Ryan, who was the defensive coordinator of the 85 Bears team, and his 46 defense. Well, the greatness of that defense, it showed in the data. 12.4 points per game allowed through the season, 10 points allowed cumulatively through three playoff wins on the road to Super Bowl victory. Enough said. And the third and last reason that the 85 Bears enjoy iconic status, it just goes to what I'll call the it factor. The 85 Bears definitely enjoyed the it factor. Consider the personalities on that team. You had Walter Payton, one of the greatest running backs in football history. Jim McMahon, a quarterback. You had the monsters of the Midway when it came to defense. Mike Singletary's eyes, William the Refrigerator Perry, and so on. Heck, even the coaches brought the it factor when it came to personalities. You had Hall of Famer and Pittsburgh native Mike Ditka as the head coach, of course. And as I said, the charismatic and at the same time volatile Buddy Ryan as the defensive coordinator. That is truly a team of personalities. And what I always find strange about the Bears team in 85 was, despite their greatness, they managed to catch lightning in a bottle for only one singular but epic season. So the Bears of that era, they weren't so much a dynasty as they were perhaps one of the greatest teams in a single season within a storied history of the National Football League. And by the way, you can read where I placed the 85 Bears defense on my list of the top 10 NFL defenses of the Super Bowl era on nickdeolius.com. Just go to the website and look under the main menu, click topics, and then commentary, and then sports for the tabs and the submenu. Tell me what you think. But episode 85, it goes to the Bears. All right, let's start connecting dots and making connections as we do for all episodes of the Far Middle. Where'd we start, right? We dedicated the episode to a football team that survived the test of time, whose legacy has aged quite well. But sometimes when it comes to the elite of professions or endeavors, that's not going to be the case. And unfortunately, we have a situation of the expert class that was making bold statements and driving policy that affects all of us, and then having those prescriptions exposed as being horribly wrong in a relatively brief period of time. The situation I want to highlight is with the elite expert technical journal in the arena of medicine, that is The Lancet. Now, The Lancet has all kinds of views. Many of them are strident and left of center or outright leftist. And those views range from climate change to COVID and everything in between. And on the topic of COVID and the policies that go with trying to contain it, back in March of 2020, The Lancet published an editorial, and this editorial laid out a couple of bold proclamations. I could try to paraphrase them, but probably it's best if I just quote directly from that editorial from March of 2020. For first, The Lancet said, quote, "China's success rests largely with a strong administrative system that it can mobilize in times of threat, combined with the ready agreement of the Chinese people to obey stringent public health procedures," end quote. Now, the editorial went on to say Western countries, quote, "must abandon their fears of the negative short-term public and economic consequences that may follow from restricting public freedoms is part of more assertive infection control measures, end quote. Well, going from March of 2020 to January of 2023 clearly exposes the flaws and the failings of the views expressed in this editorial by The Lancet. China's stringent zero COVID measures have been an absolute failure, to the point where even that totalitarian government felt compelled to reverse course and loosen the policies. The advice of The Lancet and the tactics of the Chinese Communist Party, they've been proven to not just be flawed, but also to wreck economies and destroy quality of life, and in many instances make overall health and wellness of the citizenry worse. Now, what's interesting is not so much that The Lancet's prescriptions ended up being so wrongheaded, but instead how the expert class can fumble something so horribly, but then simply shrug it off as if it never occurred and keep lecturing and demanding prescriptions that the rest of society follows across the same wide spectrum of issues. It's almost as if the expert class feels it achieves its merit badge at some point to become an expert, and then that becomes a badge that the expert enjoys for life, no matter how poorly the expert prescriptions end up playing out in the real world. So the next time that you see a view or a policy or advice offered up by The Lancet, think long and hard before you jump on board or before you begin to follow it. Speaking of experts and policy, I want to connect to the next dot, which will be our Treasury Secretary, Dr. Janet Yellen, and an op-ed she published probably a couple weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal. And the op-ed's title was How the Biden Administration, I think the term used was, Has the Economy Back on Track? Well, you constant listeners know that I am a sucker for that type of a title and that type of a periodical coming from that type of an expert. So I read on. And what was ludicrous in this op-ed from Secretary Yellen was that she said that the top economic priority of the Biden administration was to tackle inflation. And then in the very next paragraph, she pointed out that energy has been a key focus of the administration. Unfortunately, that's all too true, because the focus on energy has done great damage to not just our energy security, but also to the overall economy. In fact, when Secretary Yellen attempts to list off the accomplishments achieved in the arena of energy, the only two she wanted to mention were capping the price of Russian oil and selling over 180 million barrels of oil from our strategic petroleum reserve. Those aren't strategic moves. Those aren't astute moves. Those are simply short-term gimmicks aimed at covering up a growing and massive crisis when it comes to energy security. And those moves and gimmicks are certainly not in the interests of tackling inflation. Yeah, those two paragraphs side by side, they are ridiculous on their face. If your top priority is to tackle inflation, then you would never pursue the energy tactics and policies that this administration has pursued over the past 2 years. Just think about what the administration has imposed upon the American economy when it comes to energy. It stops private investments into infrastructure like natural gas pipelines. It mandates the transportation sector to convert to electric vehicles. It subsidizes heavily expensive, intermittent, and difficult to impossible to scale forms of electricity generation, like wind and solar. And it restricts access to manufacturing more domestic oil and natural gas on federal lands. Every single one of those measures in the whole of government under the Biden administration have been designed and focused on creating energy scarcity and raising energy costs. Higher energy costs necessarily quickly manifest into inflation across the economy. Speaking of economy and energy policy, within days of Secretary Yellen's op-ed, news came out that over 1,300 workers are going to be losing their jobs at the Stellantis Jeep Cherokee plant that's in Illinois. And most of these workers, by the way, if not all of them, they're represented by the United Auto Workers Union. So why are these workers losing their jobs? Well, it all starts with energy policy from the Biden administration. A key piece of that policy was the mandating of electric vehicles and the desire to phase out gasoline-powered cars and trucks. So automakers, they get that message loud and clear, and they realize that they need to retool their entire supply chains and manufacturing facilities to convert from what the consumer wants to what is going to be basically mandated by government, which of course are electric vehicles. Now, Stellantis, in this instance, has gone on record saying that it needs to raise $35 billion to invest into the electric vehicle production line over the next few years. And part of the way that they're going to raise that money relies on cutting costs and cutting family-sustaining jobs, like the over 1,300 jobs that were just eliminated in Illinois. this is the type of result that should be expected when you've got the heavy hand of government intervening into the free market to mandate, subsidize, and favor certain products or choices over others. Choice is limited. Corporations, they're going to rush to gain subsidy. Capital markets get distorted, and collateral damage ensues everywhere you look. But most especially, the collateral damage falls upon the shoulders of the middle class and middle America. That's the real energy transition at work in the real world. Yes, the energy transition in reality. With that topic, it brings us to our next connection, which is the CEO of Siemens Energy, which of course is a global multi-billion dollar conglomerate, recently had to explain why the firm was losing hundreds of millions of euros, much of it coming from hemorrhaging losses in the renewable energy business unit. So let's give a little more color on this topic. Wind turbines and solar panels, they rely heavily on materials and commodities that reside largely in locales like China, or in some instances in Africa and Russia. And those are long supply chains and are subjected to all kinds of external shocks to the system. So when zinc and nickel and copper skyrocket in cost, you can be sure that the costs of producing something like a wind turbine or a solar panel are also skyrocketing. Pretty basic. But what isn't perhaps as basic, or at least as widely understood, is that wind and solar, they require much more resource density than something like natural gas power generation. And when I speak of resource density, I'm talking about the tons of material required per unit of power output. In the case of solar, it takes nearly 14 times more material than natural gas power generation does on a tons of material per terawatt hour basis. Wind isn't much better. It requires nearly 9 times more material than natural gas power generation. Again, that's on the tons of material per terawatt hour basis. And by the way, those ratios I just mentioned, they come straight from the Department of Energy data. Now you can begin to see why Siemens is losing their shirt when it comes to trying to manufacture wind turbines and solar panels at a profit. All the cost inputs to that very long and murky supply chain are skyrocketing. And then you add in delay time because of supply chain bottlenecks, along with other inflation contributors such as labor. Suddenly, Siemens is experiencing a very different type of business transition that was tied to betting its strategy on the energy transition than what it had hoped for. And by the way, I found the CEO's quote on this topic interesting. It sort of says it all. He said, and I'll take the liberty of slightly paraphrasing here, "Never forget, renewables like wind are roughly 10 times the material compared to what conventional technologies need. So if you have problems on a supply chain, it hits wind extremely hard, and this is what we see." That's what the CEO quote was. Now, what I find ironic about that quote is not that it's untrue, because it certainly is true. Instead, I have to laugh over how he started the quote with the phrase, "never forget." Never forget, consumers and taxpayers and voters and the public, they can't forget what they were never told. Policymakers never mentioned to the stakeholders that wind and solar are extremely material intensive and frankly much more environmentally destructive with higher carbon footprints than alternative sources of energy like natural gas. So if you were never told those facts, how could you forget them in the first place? Yet what we were never told and what policymakers conveniently failed to mention is becoming increasingly obvious and apparent to everyone across society and our economy as the flaws and the shortcomings of the vaunted energy transition, they continue to rear their ugly heads. Boy, the connections for episode 85, they're linking up fast and furious because the Siemens situation, it reminds me of Pilke's Iron Law of Climate, which I want to hit as the next connection. So his Iron Law of Climate posits that when forced to choose between economic growth and climate action, politicians will always pick economic growth. Now that used to be the case for a long time, but the Iron Law has rusted away today to where it no longer applies. Why? Because now climate action gets coupled with state intervention in government spending, making it just frankly irresistible to politicians. So tackling climate change has become a powerful drug to the bureaucrat and the expert and the politician. You see, the Iron Law of Pilke has run smack into the Iron Triangle of government. And I discuss the Iron Triangle at length in my book Precipice, which you can order on Amazon, and please do so if you haven't already. But the Iron Triangle has three corners, one being the elected official or judge, the other corner being the special interest or lobby, and then the last corner being the appointed government bureaucrat. And the special interest funds the campaign of the elected official. The elected official appoints the government bureaucrat, and the government bureaucrat sets the rules to benefit the special interest or the lobby. And the non-virtuous circle propagates, growing larger and larger, to the point where state intervention into things like energy, under the fake cover of tackling climate change, it grows and supersedes Pilkey's iron law of climate. Now, it's all about more government control and more special interest graft, and economic growth is demoted to second rank, and that is why our leaders insist on doubling down on the failing energy transition policy mandates, even when they clearly are harming our economy and world. So sometimes energy realities and facts, they get conveniently covered over or glossed over when elites desire to propagate a myth. And that brings us to another connection, this time in the arena of law schools. For years, U.S. News and World Report, they issued law school rankings. In these rankings, they were hugely important and impactful for the law programs and for students and for employers. Not surprisingly, the programs at the top of each year's list reflected the who's who of the Ivy League and elite academia. Yale and Harvard were perennial programs at the top of the list, which of course isn't a shock. But things are changing when it comes to this law school ranking. Specifically, Yale and Harvard announced that they are pulling out of the law school rankings that they dominated forever. Now, why in the world would they ever do that? The official reason is that the administrators and the faculty at these institutions say that they can't reconcile their principles with the methodology of the rankings. Now, some might call that being too woke, but for sure I would consider it being an attack on meritocracy. And I suspect the pulling out of the rankings doesn't have as much to do with the promoted principles of Yale and Harvard. Instead, I think it reflects two realities. First, these elite law schools, along with elite academia in general, they desperately desire to be able to subjectively and arbitrarily decide which students they admit. So if you abandon program rankings, that would be consistent with the same programs wanting to abandon entry standardized test scores, class rankings, GPA, and all these other objective measures of student worthiness and achievement, which would leave the programs to do what they truly desire, which is to use purely subjective criteria, whether it's demographics or something else, to decide who they admit and how they run their programs. It's become problematic for a law school to explain why they didn't offer admission to a student with, say, higher entrance exam scores or higher undergrad performance or better accomplishments than a student who they admitted that didn't have those performance metrics, but they fit whatever the school was targeting. So this withdrawal from the rankings, it's an opportunity to justify the withdrawal of objective measures on admissions and doing it in a way where the university or the law program can shirk accountability. Now, another reason Yale and Harvard withdrew from the rankings might be a simple one. They don't need the rankings. Harvard will get its pick of the litter because, you know, it's Harvard. So when you couple the advantage of withdrawal from rankings helping to support and be consistent with withdrawal from objective measures and admissions for students alongside the reality there's no price to pay by not being in the rankings because of your super elite status, hey, it's not a shock that Harvard and Yale are taking these positions with withdrawal from rankings and standing behind the veneer of doing the right thing that's consistent with their values. Yes, our elite colleagues in academia, they can make quite the hollow pronouncements at times. And speaking of hollow pronouncements from the elite, I have to make the next connection and talk a little bit about a statement that came from the G20 at a recent summit that I believe was in Indonesia. And this occurred a little while ago in late November, but the statement from the G20 was so silly that I have to bring it up on this episode of The Far Middle. The declaration said that war in Ukraine was hurting the global economy, and the summit leaders made it clear that the declaration was unanimous, which I guess was meant to show that they really meant it. And there was a quote in the declaration that I thought was amusing, which was, quote, "Today's era must not be of war," end quote. How profound, how brave, how insightful. Now, this is the G20 and its leadership, which basically means this is our leadership. This is what they convene for days on end all over the planet to debate and discuss, Talk about being the master of the obvious. It's time to start asking, if this is all the G20 can produce, why continue with the G20? Brings to mind a question for the next connection. What's the cost of all this? When the G20 can't get past the obvious, when the myth of an energy transition continues to be propagated and funded by government, and when the most elite of academic institutions veer from meritocracy to pure subjectivity, there's going to be a significant and tangible cost to society and the economy. I think we may be starting to see that cost manifest in metrics. It may be perhaps metrics that are obscure and that many aren't familiar with, but they are quite important to all. So I wanted to talk about some of these metrics. I was reading an article recently that brought up a very interesting measurement technique or metric to speak of. That metric was total factor productivity. And total factor productivity looks to measure how much innovation contributes to growth, particularly economic growth. Now, this metric has been around for a while, and again, very few people know of it or talk about it. But what I found fascinating was that total factor productivity grew just 0.5% a year over the past decade, which is half the rate that it grew in the 1960s. In other words, total factor productivity is a metric that is capturing how the United States is progressively becoming less efficient when it comes to innovation, research, and scientific investment. Now, why might that be? Well, this is where it gets interesting. The common view that you hear in the media and in academia is that there's not enough investment into research and innovation by government. And on top of it, there are too many strings attached to research dollars. The popular argument from the experts is we need more government money in research and with more freedom to spend it however academia or research entities see fit. And I'm sure that'll turn out great for taxpayers, right? I think there's another explanation, though, a more accurate explanation as to why total factor productivity is falling. The reason is that funding into research and innovation is increasingly being driven by government. And worse, it's increasingly being dictated by ideology. Energy, once again, serves as a beautiful example. If you want to spend taxpayer money researching, whatever that means, the next iteration of wind or solar or hydrogen or fusion or EVs, you have little problem securing funding. The problem is you also face little chance of making any serious inroads when it comes to innovation that can be applied in reality. Such research efforts faithfully fulfill the ideology, but they miserably fail in the reality. That's sort of how we were forced to plow trillions of dollars into the energy transition, yet we see no appreciable movement in energy mix today. So when you start funding the ideology through the research that fits it, and you ignore the reality that research and innovation should be driving toward, it should not be a surprise that total factor productivity starts to slack off significantly. In the 1960s, reality and legitimate need in the free market, they had a much heavier influence on where and how research was conducted, and thus how innovation unfolded. Today, research is funded and driven and directed by ideology, and that ideology flies in the face of scientific reality. So when you see the R&D expenditures are at the highest percentage of GDP that we've seen in the past 60 plus years, and the total factor productivity is at one of the lowest points in the past 60 plus years, it all begins to make sense. We're getting exactly what we should expect to get. And until we change our approach and drop the ideology, total factor productivity, it's only going to get worse, and the benefits of innovation that we would all stand to enjoy, they're going to become fewer and farther between. Well, we are out of time for episode 85, and in the words of Led Zeppelin, let's bring it on home. That's a song off of Led Zeppelin 2. Actually, it was originally done by bluesman Sonny Boy Williamson. Anyway, we've been talking about the importance of competitiveness and sense of urgency and not getting bogged down by ideology and government bureaucracy. January, that month marks the month when back in 1944, the Battle of Anzio in the Italian campaign of World War II kicked off. The idea the Allies had was a good one. The intent at Anzio was to outflank German forces at the winter line midway up the Italian peninsula and to enable an attack on Rome. But it wasn't going to be easy. The success of an amphibious landing at Anzio, which was on the coast and close to Rome, it had to deal with land that was a basin consisting substantially of reclaimed marshland, and it was surrounded by mountains. And the element of surprise was going to be absolutely crucial. And on top of the surprise, the Allies needed to move quickly once landed at Anzio to move inland off the beach before the Germans reacted and counterattacked it. If the Allies waited, and if they weren't decisive, the Germans were going to take the mountains around the basin of the beachhead, and that was going to be really bad news for the Allies. U.S. General Mark Clark, he led the effort for the Americans. He understood the risks, but he was a poor leader, and he had subordinate leaders who might have been actually even worse. So although the initial landing achieved complete surprise at Anzio with no opposition, and a jeep patrol even made it as far as the outskirts of Rome early on, the Allies didn't move decisively, and they failed to capitalize. The Allies delayed advance, and German Field Marshal Albert Kesselring, he didn't hesitate. Kesselring moved every unit he could into a defensive ring around the Anzio beachhead, and he flooded the reclaimed marsh with salt water. For weeks, it was an absolute bloodbath for the Allies. In fact, it was some of the worst casualties of the entire war. Now, after a change in American leadership, putting General Truscott in charge, and months of brutal fighting, the Allies finally broke out from Anzio in May of 1944. Horrible price was paid, far greater than should have been paid by the Allies, and we were lucky to prevail, frankly. So why were we lucky? Well, because inefficiency and indecisiveness and bureaucracy and poor leadership, they're never going to be a match for strong leadership that exhibits the opposite traits. Clark and his team got it wrong and didn't adjust. Kesselring was a brilliant commander, and he got it right. And by the way, Kesselring is a villain in my mind, although a brilliant one, particularly when you consider what he did to the people of Italy during World War II. So we are in a competitive conflict today with adversaries, and the stakes are just as high as they were in the 1940s. If America and the West do not get better leadership, do not drop the ideology and embrace the reality, and if we continue to move sluggishly and inefficiently, we're going to lose the current confrontation with our adversaries. It's not Anzio and it's not bullets yet, but there is a war, and it's largely being waged economically and via policy. Let's wake up and win this thing. Talk to you in a week. Stay warm.